You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2016 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Cameron Beeler on the subject, Our Kingdom Lives. This class is titled, My Offering.
Yesterday we spoke about priesthoods, and actually I started off by telling you that priesthoods wasn't the intent of my study. It was just what I realized I had to go through if I was going to understand the question on tithing so that I could go and speak to this gentleman who is being abused. And I'd like to connect two or three things. I'd like to connect the priesthood to the tithing conversation. And then I want to connect the tithing conversation to what is really intended for us, because we also are a priesthood. And then if I have time, I want to kind of touch on the contrast between organization, religion as organization versus versus what's intended for a family of God, right? Because we face that. That's a reality in our day, and it can be very confusing. Especially, it was very confusing for me, and I'm sure there's at least a handful of people in here who also see a very well-accepted pattern and question why we operate the way we do, and why, you know, and why there's, you know, a range of different thinking about church-like behavior. That's not really the first point of my class, and we may not make it there, but it ultimately gets there. At least for me, it ultimately took me to a place where I didn't expect to go. So, I was doing a little bit of meditation on this morning, and mixed with the soreness of the 7 miles from yesterday, which, by the way, the Oregon Trail is beautiful. Love it. But you do pay a price. I was kind of thinking this morning about the institution, as it were, of the law. And, you know, we kind of talked about yesterday that there was kind of a progression, and it was actually introduced in a reverse manner. And I think that's because God wanted us to see the first priesthood as actually, if you wanted to hierarchically describe priesthoods, the first priesthood is the Melchizedekian priesthood. The last priesthood is the Levitical priesthood, and the firstborn is in the middle, and there's almost no information on the firstborn priesthood. But what's interesting about the Levitical priesthood is it's a governance authority for the Mosaic law. If you have law and you don't have anyone that teaches and manages and, you know, and instruct, you know, I say instruct and teaching, those are like the same thing. And even, but if you don't have anybody doing that, then it's a law without teeth, and it's a law without any real merit in that context. It's like saying that you're bound to only drive, you know, 70, but don't go under 40. Please don't go under 40 if I'm on the road. But anyway, but if we didn't have police, it didn't have police and didn't have cameras, then what is it? Well, it's a bunch of words on signs, right, with no teeth. And the Mosaic law without the priesthood would be like words without signs and no teeth, right? And so I kind of want to bring the point, because what happens in a practical way is the priesthood was not about selecting the best of the best from the community who cared and loved for the community and making sure they were there to build the community. They were governing the Mosaic law. And what practically happened is that as a foundation, you had something that would govern the behaviors of people, and if they became extreme, they had a way of taking care of that. And if you had an environment that was managed reasonably, then individuals who were looking at the law and seeing more than just the law could then begin to aspire to spiritual behavior and spiritual thinking, and it was in the law and it was embedded there so they could see it and become more than just people who follow rules, right? So the law was there to provide a platform that would create an environment, and the Levites were there to govern that so that individuals could aspire to spiritual living with an environment that would be complementary to spiritual living. But the Levites couldn't bring the people to spiritual. They couldn't bring a person to us. You can't teach me until I become spiritual. You can't teach me and desire so much that I become spiritual that I then become spiritual. It's something that comes from inside out. The information and the environment may complement my desire to be spiritual, but if I don't have that desire in me, it won't happen, right? So the Levites were never going to make the people spiritual, but they provided a great environment for it. So the kind of the thinking I wanted to kind of draw out of that, and I know we kind of touched on it yesterday, was that the Levites didn't even have to actually be spiritual, but they did have to stand, right, and govern what was put in place. And then we find out that the real problem by the time you get to Jesus is that they created a lot of other stuff to assist in their governing, and that's not what God put in place, it's what man put in place. And when man does that, what happens? What happens? If you leave man in control of man long enough, what's going to happen? It's going to, yeah, that's right. Right? And we have no, anyway, I'm not going to go there. So anyway, but it's true. But the interesting thing is, what's interesting is when you get to the firstborn, I don't know if I touched about this, but if you have a firstborn priesthood and the firstborn are taken out of the families, there's no discussion at all where they go. I mean, if you look at the Levitical, they're already a tribe that has their boundaries and their constraints. And God says, I'm going to make you a priest of the people. And I'm going to move you from here. And I'm just going to take and put them right here. And now the people are all the way around them. But they're still just themselves, right? And ultimately, they get in the land. And God says, well, we're going to change that. And I'm going to take this part. And you're going to be in that tribe. And this part, you're going to be in that tribe, right? And for those listening to the video, I'm not clearing my throat. And then they're going to take this piece and they're going to put them over here. And now the Levites aren't their tribe with everybody around them. They're actually in the midst of the people. And you see God beginning to move something, and it's really intended for us to see it. If you put it on a map and you then started seeing the Levites all throughout the land, you're starting to see that, wait, the people who are supposed to represent God are now in the heart of all the different tribes. That's an interesting progression. Because unless you're in the middle of the tribes, you actually can't learn to care for the people. Because as long as I'm in my house with my household and everybody's around me, I'm not actually with them. Hard to be a priesthood who loves the people if you're still in your house. But the firstborn priesthood is actually completely different. It's like the eldest of, you know, everybody in here is part of a family, and everybody in here has somebody in your family who's the eldest man. And the eldest man in your family, presumably, it's a model. We know it's not perfect, but presumably the eldest gentleman in your family who's caring for the family, who now God is saying, now you don't belong to the family, you belong to me, you're my priest, has the concern and the welfare of the family at heart because it's his family, right? He's the caretaker. What does the firstborn get when we talk about inheritance? Yeah, that's right. He gets two. He gets two coins. No, he gets a double portion, right? It's interesting because a double portion comes into conversation when we talk about inheritance on a spiritual level. But that's an aside just for thinking. But it's interesting because the visual of a firstborn priesthood is that the firstborn don't have to go somewhere. They're already where they belong. They're already where they belong. They're in the family. They love the family. They know the family. They care for the family. Right? So they don't have to learn to love. See, the Levites would have to learn to love. And so the basis of the priesthood is the presumption, as it were, that you already love the family. And as the next generation of firstborn comes up and the next generation of firstborn come up, they're raised and they don't have to go anywhere. They stay in the family. And I'm going to start bringing that up because we're going to talk about provision. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on provision because tithing is a form of provision. And then you get the Melchizedekian priesthood. And the basis for the Melchizedekian priesthood is very important to understand because the basis for these priesthoods are because of where you come from, but the basis of the Melchizedekian priesthood is completely different. And I know in the scripture we only have two overt references to Melchizedek, and I'm not going to assert a truth. I'm just going to tell you what I think is happening. I think what's happening is that the name Melchizedek isn't a person's name. I think it's a title form. I think there's a person with a name under the title form. I have an idea of who I think it is, but that's not important. And actually, I know it's not overtly important, or we would have been told explicitly that, but I think there's something you can read between the lines and infer who it might be. And that goes back to Genesis 14. And you can go figure that out for yourself and see if we come up with the same conclusions, which would be fun. But the thing I think is going on is that God is actually saying, here is a man who has mastered right living in his life, and I'm going to ascribe righteousness on him. And this is a man who also is a master in his life of peace, and I'm going to ascribe him the master of peace. The concept of king can be a literal king with a crown on a throne, but the concept of king also speaks to mastery. And in this context, when we looked at Hebrews 7 yesterday, and it talked about his name, you know, Melchizedek is king of righteousness, or in the Hebrew, justice, and king of Salem, because he happened to be the king of what is now Jerusalem, right, is that he's a king of peace. But what happens here is that a man cannot say, yes, but I'm a righteous man who's very peaceful, therefore I am a, you know, that's not how it works. What this demonstrates, this Melchizedek role demonstrates, is he's someone who is actually explicitly picked by God to be, you're my representative, not on the basis of your birth, not on the basis of your family, not on the basis of your masculinity or femininity, which in this case, there isn't a conversation on masculine or feminine. I think this is a Galatians 3:16 conversation. The basis is that you have mastered righteous living, and I'm ascribing righteousness, like the Abraham, God ascribing righteousness to Abraham in Galatians 3, and you are living in peace. You're a peace bringer. And because of those two realities, I want you as mine. Right? And when we get into like the 1 Peter 2 conversation, 2 verse 9, and it says that God is ascribing to us reality that isn't true in the moment. Right? You're a chosen people, a holy nation, right? A royal priesthood. He's saying, that's Melchizedek. You are a royal king-priest conversation right there. And here's the thing. I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself. Have I mastered peace? No, I have not. Have I got mastery and righteous living in my life? This might come as a shock. No, I have not. Right? And yet God has already ascribed that this is what you are, and I think in parentheses, to be. Right? Is that what you aspire to? Is that what you want? Because he's already claimed you. What does that mean? I mean, when I take that and I say that's great in theory, but what is that in practice? What does that mean? Hopefully today we'll get there. Right, but the key thing is Melchizedek isn't about a person. It's about God's selection for the role he wants us to aspire to and live into. And that means lives have to change. And Jesus is the high priest because A, when you talk about the one who's mastered peace, he's it. When you want to talk about the one who's mastered righteousness, he's it. And God has said he is the high priest. If there is ever a high priest, then there must be a priesthood in the order of a priesthood, Melchizedek, right? And we are told that we belong to him, priesthood. We're in his order. And therefore, we're having ascribed upon us a role that we must live up to. And it is by selection. It is by selection because of God, what God calls us to. Practical conversation, tithing. Okay, so you get into the conversation on tithing, and I let my notes go off. Good thing I've got plenty of battery on my notes. Look, we put ourselves in weird positions when we start using digital devices. But in the tithing conversation, there's a Deuteronomy verse. I think it's chapter 10. And what it basically says is you have two or three conversations, and it's just kind of a side note to me. But first you have the conversation that God says, you know, I have removed you from the inheritance of Israel, and I have become your inheritance. And then and he says that actually in three different places, and we had John read the verse for us yesterday. But then there's another verse that says that the people shall tithe to you, and that shall become your inheritance. The people have an inheritance, but the tithe shall become your inheritance. Wow. So it's very interesting to me, and I start looking at a practical reality. See, if you've got a plot of land, what can you do with it? Yeah, exactly. You got a place for your house. You got a place for your, you know, sheep. You got a place to farm. You can create food. You can survive, right? If you got sheep, you can eat them. You can shear them. You have clothing, right? if you have nothing, you can do a whole lot of nothing. Right? And the Levites were just taken out of the conversation of inheritance. The people of God, the 12 tribes with inheritance, are going to receive something, but Levi, just they have God. And I mean, you know, Jesus is like, you know, I haven't had anything to eat because this is my food and my drink that I do. And that's great, and it's true, but you can't survive long without food, without clothing, without shelter, right? And these are the things. And so it becomes a very practical matter. Now, if you've got this tribe and they've got to survive and they're going to do a service for the community, what makes sense? How should they get their provision? From the community. It makes sense, right? It makes sense. And I kind of want to think about it. Hopefully the notes were handed out. I'm sure they were. But one of the questions I have on there is, what's the ratio, more or less, of the community to the Levites? Ish, right? Ish. Now, if I said, well, I want you to take 12%, I got to tell you, there's already people going, 12%. How do I get 12%? I don't have a whole number. 12%, I have to do. But God said, look, make this easy. There's 12 to 1. We're going to make this 10%. Now, if 12 give 10 to 1, right, that reduces the income of 12 from, let's just do simple math, from 100% of what they had to 90%. That's reasonable. How many people pay 10% today? If you are, I want to know where you live because I'm moving to you, right? I pay 34%. Yeah, and if I make a little more, I pay 42%. And that's in the land of capitalism, right? That's what they say. Anyway, so I don't want to go there. In their community, they were paid 10%. That's not unreasonable. But not only did they have to pay 10%, that means that the Levites would have how much? 12 tribes, 10%, 120. But of the 120 they had, do you know what they had to do? That's exactly right. They had to give 10% back. So here's the deal. 12 tribes would give 10% to Levi. 12 tribes would go from 100% of what they had to 90% of what they had. Levi would have 120%, but they would have to give 10% of their 120%. That makes, I'll do the math for you, 108%. Thank you very much. Just in case I got it wrong, you were right on. They'd have 108%, but they're also responsible. They're responsible for the poor that can't provide and can't, you know, reap. The grain that was on the edges that wasn't harvested and that kind of thing. So they have extra responsibilities on top of that. All right. So that's not unreasonable. But let me ask you, what's the practical outcome of 12 supporting one? What, let me ask you a question. The community of Israel is in drought. Let's just create a scenario. They're in drought and they're not producing a lot of grain. What is the reality of the priest? That's right. And there's another side effect to this, right? Because if you can't afford to give, your giving can actually reduce. Instead of, you know, half of the lamb or the sheep, you're giving a dove. So what happens is when the community goes into hardship, the priest goes into hardship. I can tell you he's not driving his Mercedes C-Class around the neighborhood, right? He's walking. And when the community's doing very well, what's the state of the priest? That's right. Suddenly the doves are no longer what's being given because everybody can afford the sheep and the bulls and the calves and they're getting their full portion, right? So here's a weird thing. When the community is doing really poor, the priesthood are doing worse. And when the community is doing really well, the priesthood does better. So guess what that builds into the conversation? Justice. It builds in feed. It's a God-given feedback loop into the priesthood, and they can't operate independently of the welfare of their people, because you see, they're not firstborns, right? They're a tribe taken out of a midst of people who have no relationship to these other people. So God has built in a provision and a feedback loop from the community to the priests that keeps the priests and the community in check. Does that make sense? But without the 10%, I mean, they're the governing authority even prior to the kings coming on the scene. Remember, God warned them, if you get the kings, it's going to just be more money. It's going to cost you more because you're going to have to still take care of the priesthood. And now the kings are going to demand more. And they're going to create armies and they're going to demand more. And they're going to do this and they're going to demand more. Take your daughters and demand more. Right? So, but this isn't the king study. So, I want to talk about that because it's interesting. You've got to start with understanding what is the provision was a necessity, and it created not only the support of the governing group, but it also created a feedback loop to the governing group that helped them stay connected to the people and the welfare of the people, right? And I can tell you that when we see a model day of some super preacher and he's got 10,000 people in his church and maybe he's got four or five assistant pastors and whatnot, you still have six people, primary operators, and maybe a board of another 15 or 20 to 6,000. And what happens is it creates an inequity, right, amongst other things. Because that was never what God did in his plan. That is never what God did in his plan. With a governing priesthood. So the second thing, however, and we already kind of discussed this, was the provision. What would be the provision of the firstborn? How would they survive? Just somebody take a shot at it. I know you thought you were getting your glasses adjusted, but I actually thought you were volunteering then. Absolutely. So I don't visualize, Ben, thank you, I don't visualize that the community of Israel would pull their goods and then find the firstborns and divvy the goods back out to the firstborns. The firstborns are in the family. So when mom cooks a meal, the firstborn's at table with you. You're eating with the firstborn priest, right? They're not off in their firstborn tent. They're in the family. So you have your provision and you have land and you have cattle. It's part of the family's cattle, right? And so you get this model going. So they don't need a special provision. They're cared for inside the family. Think about that. So the firstborn priesthood would not have required a formal tithe because they had a different model, right? And that applies to us, by the way. Melchizedek has an interesting scenario because we see the conversation with Abraham. I have a couple of different premises on this. Bruce had a premise yesterday. You want to share your premise briefly of the contribution? I'm going to call you on the spot. You don't have to. He had an interesting conversation yesterday about there's the battle of the four kings and the five kings, and then Abram goes up to, you know, to get the spoils and to get his nephew, and he comes back down and meets in Salem, and maybe there was a conflict going on. Yeah, I called you on the spot, I know, but there's kind of a potential conflict going on between the king of Sodom and between Abram. I kind of view it a little differently, but what ends up happening is Abram gives a tenth. Before he does anything else, he gives a tenth of what he has to Melchizedek. And I find it pretty interesting because Melchizedek, A, is not involved in the conflict. He's a king of what? Yeah, he's a king of righteousness. He's a righteous man, and he's a king of peace. I don't witness any insinuation that he's owing tribute to anybody. And I don't see any insinuation that he's allying with people to go to war, right? All I see is that he's actually not part of that whole conflict conversation. But when they come to meet with him, he's actually already brought bread and wine. He's there to bring peace, a communal meal and bring peace. And Abram, I think there's a kind of thing that's going on with Abram. Has anybody here thought about that, studied that at all, have any ideas? I mean, I want to tell you what I think, but it isn't just, this is about you, not me. Any ideas about why the 10% was given to Melchizedek? I mean, he's a king of Salem. Does he need the 10%? Absolutely. I think that's what's going on. And I think he also respects Melchizedek. And tribute can happen for more than one reason. Tribute can happen for protectorate. You know, you're a powerful king and I'm weak in the land and I want to give you a tribute because I want to become part of your protectorate. But Melchizedek isn't noted for his military power. He's noted for his spiritual power, spiritual and moral authority. So when Abraham gives a tithe to him, I believe it's a free will offering. I believe it's a free will offering in honor and respect of who Melchizedek is and what he represents. Melchizedek doesn't need the finances. It's fine. Yes. Absolutely. And so offered to tithe. It does. It actually well establishes it. And we kind of need those hints. Otherwise, we'd have a lot to read between the lines, right? So Hebrews 7 is a great verse in that. But yeah, so Abraham has a vision of the gospel. This is what Brother Booker said. Has a vision of the gospel ahead of the Mosaic law. And, you know, understands the role of Melchizedek and his role and his moral and priestly superiority. And when he tithes him as a freewill offering, he's actually acknowledging the moral and spiritual superiority of that priesthood. And you got to think about, because the priesthood isn't one where Melchizedek is going to explain the trials and troubles of Abram to God. Melchizedek is God's priest, and he's there to explain what is righteous to people who aspire to be spiritual and godly people. So Abraham, in all his searching and following God, would recognize that this Melchizedek is God's authority to teach, to guide, and to lead. Does that make sense? And he would respect and honor that, and he would give gifts to this man, not just because of who the man is, but because of what the role is, especially since the Melchizedekan priesthood is one that's God handpicked to represent him, right? And that's pretty amazing, because we know that Abram, who is Abram at this point in time, loved and respected and was following God. So he would love and respect and follow God's priest. Does that make sense? So this wasn't the law says you have to give 10% on an annual basis to provide for it. That's not what this is at all. Which priesthood are we supposed to be aspiring to, living up to? I think I've said it once. Not the Buddhist priesthood. What is it? Melchizedekan priesthood, right? If you said Buddhist, we're going to have a talk. I just made that up. But that's an interesting thing, because the world today says, well, you're Christians and you're supposed to tithe. And the world says that. I mean, the world that knows Christianity says that. Christian churches say that. What's interesting, though, is the population of the body of believers are actually called not to be people who are looking to listen to a priest, but rather to learn to live in a way that we become echoes of the priesthood. We become part of the priesthood. So who's greater? Maybe we should just turn to Hebrews 7. Let's do that real quick. We're going to start with, so I want somebody to read the first five. Who would like to read the first five verses of Hebrews? Yeah, thank you.
This Melchizedek was king of Salem and priest of God Most High. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. First, his name means king of righteousness. Then also, king of Salem means king of peace. Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. Just think how great he was. Even the patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder. Now the law requires the descendants of Levi who become priests to collect a tenth from the people, that is, their brothers, even though their brothers are descended from Abraham.
Right. And if you look at the next four verses, which you can put in your notes, it actually then goes on to make the point that Abraham was still in his loins, right? And so figuratively, Levi would offer the tithe through Abraham to Melchizedek, right? And this is a pretty interesting point, because then what he's saying is he's telling us there's actually a hierarchy. There's a greater priesthood and a lesser priesthood, right? And the point is made in there, who's greater, the one who offers the offering or one who receives the offering? Who's greater, the one that receives the blessing or the one who gives the blessing? And while this was happening to Abraham, Levi is figuratively still in his loins, therefore Melchizedek is the priesthood. And we're called to be part of the family of Melchizedek, right? Or the order of Melchizedek. And that's what we see in Scripture. So I leave that to you, because then the conversation of tithing then changes the color and taste of the tithing discussion. Because remember, it's something that was governed so that a portion of the family could have a inheritance and survive. But what of us? I want to kind of look at a couple things. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 10. That's it. 2 Corinthians 10. So follow me to 2 Corinthians 10 real quick. And I'm going to show you, there's a conversation that's being had here And Paul is talking to one of the ecclesias who is promised to give a gift. And I want to talk about the physical conversation, and I want to talk about the general, because he starts off on talking about what they've promised, and then he kind of generalizes. And then after this, we're gonna go, given time, good. We're gonna go to the next conversation, which is about spirit gifts and practical application. If I haven't scared you, no, don't be scared. It'll be all right. It'll be all right. Because I think the world looks at that, and the broader, you know, people that read the Bible broader or broadly and maybe shallowly look at this, and they interpret some things out of it. And I think they interpret incorrectly. I think they make some wrong assumptions, and I'll share with you why I think that. But I think there's something very specific that's going on in the conversation about the body and God's giving us things and how we're supposed to use them. So 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and it starts in verse 5. We're going to look 5 through 8. Who wants to read chapter 9? Yes, sir, please.
So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift you had promised. Then it will be ready as a generous gift, not as one grudgingly given. Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work.
Thank you very much. There's the broader conversation is there's actually a couple of ecclesias that need help, and I think there's also a conversation that happens later about Jerusalem and sending money to help the poor in Jerusalem. And in the conversation that happens here, what we start off with is you've kind of made a vow to contribute to these ecclesias, but then he goes into a general conversation, and the general conversation is with what you have, with the overflow of what you have, you're to contribute and give, and the one who does so willingly and happily, giving out of the surplus of what you have, will be blessed. Now, that can be misused, right? In my view, when we talk about this, if I give you $10, I'm not expecting $100. Or if I give out of something else that I have, I'm not expecting a bounty of that same thing in a immediate gratification concept. Those who love the family of God are going to inherit the kingdom. At what point is that not the blessing we're looking for, right? If we're looking for immediate gratification in this life, we've already lost track of the point of our service. We're going to take a look here real quick at 1 Corinthians 13, and we're going to have somebody read verses 8 through 13. 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 13. Who would like to read that? Anyone? Anyone?
Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.
Faith, hope, and love remain. They're the key, they're the focus of the purpose. There are things that will go away. I like what he's talking about here. Tongues, prophecies, and knowledge, which is interesting, but it makes sense when you think about it. Those things, he says, those things will cease. But he's actually alluding to a broader conversation that actually starts in 1 Corinthians 12. And I've actually got 7, but we're going to go there in a second. I want to start actually with Romans 12, 1 through 13. Who'd like to read the first 6 verses of Romans 12. Anybody raise your hand? Okay, Ben, and then Mary Ellen. Sorry, I'm being an idiot. And if you'd read 7 through 13. So, starting with Ben.
Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you. Just as each of us has one body with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, so in Christ we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. We have different gifts according to the grace given us. If a man's gift is prophesying, let him use it in proportion to his faith. If it is serving, let him serve. If it is teaching, let him teach. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. If it is showing mercy, let him do it cheerfully. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I want somebody to read for me 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7. Just the one verse. Who would like to read that for me? Yes, sir.
Now to each one, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good.
Thank you very much. There's a whole set of passages. There's two or three references to gifts as we speak that God is giving. And I want to talk about that in just a second. But what's interesting is I want to connect two things. It says that tongues and that prophesying and that knowledge will actually cease or pass away. But faith, hope, and love will never depart. That those are actually the reason for the way we're supposed to operate with what we're given. We hear in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7, that what is given for the common good. And I've got to ask a couple of questions. I'm going to share one thing from a discussion on Jesus giving the Holy Spirit to his disciples to go do something. We'll talk about that and come back to this. So I'm going to go ahead and go to the conversation. And there's two or three things we want to kind of hold on to before we go fully into this conversation. But does anybody remember what happened when Jesus gave the Holy Spirit to his disciples, that they might go out through the land and heal and cast out demons, as it says? And then, anybody remember that story? At the end, right, they come back to him, right? And what do they say? They have a distinct problem. What's the problem? It wasn't that they had a problem using this, you know, having the power of the Holy Spirit and doing what he was asked to do, but it was like at the end, they met this one they couldn't heal. They couldn't heal. And like, we can't heal this guy. You know, you gave us this power, we've gone and done this thing, we can't heal this guy. And Jesus says, but it takes much fasting and prayer. And I find it interesting because there's a purpose for fasting and prayer. The purpose for fasting and prayer is to put away our desire for immediate gratification and start placing God back in our life and remembering who's first. So as we fast and pray, we're continuing to put ourselves down and raise God up and remember that God is the reason and God is leading us and God is the... So when Jesus tells them, but this one takes much fasting and prayer, he's actually telling us something about the problem. what he's really saying, and this is, again, me reading between the lines, what he's really saying is you didn't have a problem when you started out because it was all about God's glory. But by the time you healed and healed and healed and healed and doing all this stuff with the power of God working through you, suddenly it ceased to become about God's glory because you saw that you were healing people. And as soon as it became, you know, as soon as it, when it started out as God's healing people through me, but as soon as it started becoming I'm healing people, you can't do it. And why is that? It's because it's not a Harry Potter world where you have a wand of God's power and you're going out and using it for your purposes. It's because it's God's power operating through you, and as soon as it ceases to become about God, it's gone. Because God's not going to operate through you if it's about your glory. And what he's telling them is you've lost sight of who this is about. And you know what? I get that, because if I had the power to go and do these things, I can see how very quickly I could be impressed with how God was letting me do these things. And I think the challenge we have in the conversation on the on the verses that are here with the idea of being given gifts is the natural inclination is for man to begin to read that as if though God has given me a magic wand of power that I can now go and do stuff. And I don't believe God has ever operated that way. His power has never been available for men to do things for their own self-realization. And as soon as it becomes about man's glory, it's gone. And as such, what we begin to understand is when God is talking about here, what he's really saying is, I'm going to enable you to do things for my glory's sake. And when you acknowledge and recognize them, then they can work through you. They can work through you. Right? They can work through you. And I love the part in 1 Corinthians 12:7 because he says, and this actually fits perfectly into what we're talking about, because what he says is, the reason that these things are given to you is so that you may use them for the common good. I remember the question I have now. The things you have, whose are they? The Lord's. And if everything I have is the Lord's, then what am I? There's a specific word, and this is an open question, I know, but just try. That's the word I'm looking for. I am his steward. And this is exactly the same in the physical and the spiritual. If I am God's steward of his things and I'm spending them on my pleasures, what have I done? I've robbed him. And how do you think that's going to turn out? Right? Yeah. The laughter says it all. The chuckle. It ain't going to turn out so good. And you find out that sometimes when you have very little but you're serving God, you end up with more than you can handle. And when you have a lot and you're serving yourself, it can go away, or what you end up using it for doesn't fill you. It ceases to be effective because it's about who we serve and our attitude toward the things. And it's not just about how much I make. It's about every aspect of my life, because you're not a steward of God's money. What is money to God anyway? You are a steward of God's gift. And I want to point out something. When it was the people in Levi, it was a necessity. Did they get money from the people? They could. I mean, they had their buckets for money, but was that the only thing they got? They got animals. They got food. They got grains. They ended up with a place to live. They got, you know, they did get money, because that's a method for capitalism, which, you know, buying and selling what you need in addition. But it wasn't just, you know, it was about the provision. They didn't just get money, but when we talk about tithing, our minds go straight to money. And there's a reason for that. And it isn't good. When it comes to a community of priests, and we all have different strengths and different weaknesses, God doesn't say, now I want you to all know that we need to give our money. What does God say? That's right. We give ourselves. We all have different strengths. We're part of a body. The body has many, many parts. And if they all aren't working, it hurts. And the conversation on gifts goes into administration. There are people who are given strength of administration, the most thankless job in the world. That's the person who always does the lists. Right? It's a God-given gift. Thankfully, it's not me. I would hate that job. Right? My wife doesn't say, no, you wouldn't hate that job. You do hate that job. It's not a would be. It is. It's an is. Right? I have a completely different set of jobs. That's right. It's okay. I'm not good at it. Not only, there's a reason I hate it. I'm not good at it. What do you do? So, but God gives each one of us gifts, and the challenge is, I'm going to ask this question. I don't want you to answer me. What is your gift? If you don't know precisely what it is, right? Then that's great. That means you have an opportunity to go figure out what your gift is. But I also want to keep in mind that my gift is a service. And I would share that there are places where my gift isn't welcome, and that's fine. It is what it is. I don't go there and say, you don't want my gift, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Right? We get that. So we have to find out where we can contribute and how we contribute. And wherever I go, if people say, you know, whatever it is that you're given to give, give. Then I'm here. That's what I'm for. That's what God has given me to give. And to those who welcome it, I give it. Right? And I know that's true, but if you don't know what your gift is, you can't even start. You don't even know where to start. So you need to know what it is. If the question came out and you were like, well, it could be, you're not there yet. That's okay, right? But you need to know your gift. Because once you know what your gift is, you need to find out, how do I give? Yes, sir. The idea, so our offerings are not legally bound offerings. Our offerings are free will offerings, joyful offerings, what we want to give. Out of the gift that God gives you, what he's saying is there is an abundance. When you know what the gift is, there's an abundance, and you got to let it flow. And you can't start at the end. You give at the beginning. You give first, right? You give first. And I want to make a point. Money is one of the gifts. There are people who are blessed, and we have to operate. It's a financial reality. But I'm going to say this, and I hope I don't offend. The most valued gift you can give is time. It is not a commodity. It is a restricted, limited, finite resource. And the gift of your time is golden. Like my pun? Money is the cheapest thing you can give because it requires no personal divestment. It requires no personal emotional connection. Now, you may be emotionally connected in giving, and that's beautiful. But money requires no emotional personal investment. Time, however, time in the presence of another person, helping them through difficulty, you don't just give them the most valued resource you have in your time, but you actually connect with them and show them you love. And you know what we need? Right? We don't need thicker wallets. We need love. We can't survive without it. And an organization that tells you that what's really, really important for you to give is money is dead. The lesson of the tithe comes down to this for me. Giving ourselves to God, tithing is about 10%. A whole and living sacrifice is about total investment in God, in His intent for the creation, which is in His family. If all you have to give is 10%, that's great for the Levitical process. But if you want to be part of the family, you've got to give it all. And the practical reality of that is, look at what God has given you, what your strength is, and are you investing it in the welfare of the community, of the family? Are you helping the poor? Are you in touch with those who are needy? Are there people that are in depression that just need your love? Are there elderly people who can't get out and a drive to the store so they can actually see the sunshine for a few minutes? Amazing. It takes your time. They may not need you to pay for the groceries. They may be fine to do that. But your time is golden. Your personal commitment. What's your strength? How are you investing it? Right? And we're going to talk about that on the fifth day. All right. Thank you very much for your time. God bless the rest of your day.